Welcome to the Other Side of Potential podcast, hosted by Dr. Sharon Spano. Each weekly episode takes a deep dive into how successful family business leaders maneuver the unique dynamics between family and business. How do they align to face complex business challenges? How do they build and project generational wealth? In what ways do they pursue a lasting legacy? Join Sharon as she explores how these leaders adapt and respond to the complexity of life and business in our ever-changing world.
Join me in welcoming today's guest, Dr. Jill Weiner. Dr. Weiner is a board-certified internist. She is also the creator of the Conscious Anti-Racism Curriculum, in which she and her business partner, Maisha Claiborne, combined their insights as a white woman on her own anti-racism journey with her mind-body expertise and over 10 years practicing medicine. I've asked Dr. Weiner to be on the show today as part of our monthly Conscious Community segment because she has a unique approach to stress reduction and physical and emotional health, and it's known as the Emotional Freedom Technique. And this technique can also be used to help us explore the ways that our self-limiting beliefs create our own reality. And I'm assuming that includes our beliefs about racism, which I'm very excited to hear her perspective on. Now, her Conscious Anti-Racism Training Curriculum is available as a CME-accredited online course and as a 10-hour live virtual training, which both she and Maisha deliver in both corporate and healthcare settings. And they have worked with clients such as the Pittsburgh Business Group on Health and the National Alliance for Healthcare Purchaser Coalitions. Now, Dr. Weiner is also the host of the Conscious Anti-Racism podcast, and we'll learn more about how you can access that. And she's the co-author of the best-selling Conscious Anti-Racism book with Dr. Claiborne. Now, I've asked her to be on the show today, as I said, you know, for all of these reasons, because I know that we are in a time of great division and many of us are confused and conflicted about what side of the fence we're on because we're hearing so many different perspectives. So hopefully she can give us some ways to think about it. And if you didn't hear my show on DEI a week and a half ago or 2 weeks ago, you want to tune into that as well, because I was setting her up for this conversation. She has also published several articles on Kevin MD. She's led CME-accredited physician wellness programs around the country and lectured at the national level on stress and the benefits of meditation and tapping, which we'll learn about. She has been interviewed on multiple TV and radio shows, as well as podcasts in the medical community and beyond. So I am honored to have her on with us today. Without any further hesitation, then, welcome Dr. Weiner to the show. It is great to have you on board.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm really curious to maybe start the conversation because I find it fascinating, not so much that you went into, you know, stress reduction techniques and wellness and all of that, because that's a natural flow for a physician. Certainly what brought you to that, but then also how did that move you into the anti-racism conversation?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I was a very type A, skeptical, non-spiritual doctor type, learned to meditate when I was really burnt out in 2011, which really had a massive impact on my life. And for me was a fix for my burnout. And a few years after that, decided I wanted to become a teacher in the meditation tradition, which is a 3-month training in India. I went to do that, always thinking that I was going to come back and practice medicine, continue practicing medicine, but realized that a few things. Once I was out for a few months, I realized there was a lot of, even though I was happy and enjoying my career, there was just a lot of baseline stress that once I was out of it, it felt very liberating to be out of it. And also I had something that I could do and that I could do well that I really felt very passionate about, which is teaching meditation. So that's kind of when I, in early 2016, started to finish my teacher training and started teaching meditation. The anti-racism work started in 2016 as well, with me making a mistake, with me kind of doing something that wasn't great. I wrote a blog post after the 2016 election called "We're Going to Be Okay, I Promise," or something like that. And it was from my, like, I thought I was this new meditation teacher. I had this wisdom to share. And acquaintance of mine reached out and said, "Hey, I thought you might want to read this article that I've attached. Your blog post that you wrote is very privileged." And the article that she sent me was called "Dear White People, Please Stop Telling Me It's Going to Be Okay."
Wow. And powerful. And
she said I was privileged. And I was like, "I'm not racist. What are you talking?" You know, like, yeah, super defensive and not knowing. I didn't even know what privilege was at that point. I didn't understand. Mm-hmm. And I was super defensive. And this is someone I did not have a great relationship with, so that didn't help. But I kind of was able to get myself through that defensiveness and say, well, all right, well, I don't know what this privilege thing is, but I'm pretty sure I don't want to be doing it. And let me learn more about what she's talking about so that I don't continue to do something that could be potentially harmful. And that started my own personal journey. A lot of the stuff that you may see white people doing is learning, reading, having these huge aha moments, having these moments of like almost debilitating guilt and just reckoning with what the world, how we thought the world was and to how it actually is that I didn't see. And then I went on a training in 2019 called Allies in Action that was run by Paige Ingram and Leslie Mack and Paige Ingram. And it was a training for allies. And I am always quite honest about this. I knew I wanted to go and I signed myself up. And as it approached, I tried to come up with reasons not to go because I was scared and I didn't know what would be expected of me. And I just, my negative inner critic was like, don't do it, don't do it. But I knew that that was something that I needed to do. So I went on the retreat and it was really amazing, life-changing. And we were going through an article about the characteristics of dominant culture, which is also called white supremacy culture, which is a term that throws some people for a loop, but it's not talking about the KKK. It's talking about the culture of our country that kind of keeps white people in power, the culture of racism that isn't overt racist jokes, the culture that supports the status quo. And we were reading this article on it and doing a workshop on it. And a lot of the ways, the parts of our culture that keep propagating racism are things like defensiveness and perfectionism and the need to be comfortable, this right to comfort and a sense of urgency and all these things that I am and do all the time. And those don't inherently make me a racist or anyone, but those qualities can keep racism strong. And I realize like the way that I recognize them in myself is how am I feeling right now? And what does it feel like to be defensive? What does it feel like to have this need for everything to be perfect or to insist on being comfortable emotionally or physically all the time? And then what have I done in my journey to help get myself through that and process that and not run away from it? And so using the meditation tools, the mindfulness tools, tapping, which you mentioned we haven't yet gotten to. And I started tapping in 2017 and became a practitioner in 2019, right around the time that I went on this retreat. How can I teach people these tools to help them lean into and learn from the discomfort that comes around true work in anti-racism and social justice? Because that discomfort is what stops a lot of people. And that discomfort is ingrained in us from birth. That need to avoid discomfort at all costs, that's actually part of the problem. Sure. And so how do we recognize that? How do we teach people about the culture and about systemic racism, but also giving tools? It's hard, you know, it's learning about it is one thing, but actually learning how to participate in a productive way in trying to dismantle systems of oppression. I think that is where what we do is really unique, because Maisha and I are both experts in mind body work and in unconscious mind. And we really help people give people tools to lean into and learn from this and to really develop more emotional intelligence around conversations about race.
Oh, I have so many questions for you. So let's go back just briefly to the idea of meditation and how it changed your life, because I resonated with that in my early career, I was a child and family advocate, very much on the burnout stages of running back and forth between legislative reform and lack thereof. And, you know, our government, for those of you that are not aware, pretty much operates on a crisis intervention mode, at least with respect to social justice issues. And I was fighting for the disabled because I had a child with a disability at the time. And I had a similar experience in that I learned to practice meditation and I went off and did a very intensive retreat and came back and none of that made sense to me anymore. And I remember literally getting up going, okay, there's something deeper that I should be doing. And it sounds like you had a similar transformational moment where you realized, okay, this fast-paced life that I'm living over here isn't the life. So I want to just put that out for people to think about the power of meditation, and not to say it needs to be that necessarily disruptive, but that there is There is a lot to it. We could do a whole show on that. Maybe we can come back and we'll talk more about that. But yeah. For now, I want to keep it in the context of the anti-racism work that you're doing. And I'm wondering, because you mentioned that you are well aware that you are a white woman addressing these issues. So how does that change for you beyond what you've said? I mean, I get that you're reading and learning and leaning into it differently, but I mean, what is the biggest shift that you've had in recognizing that, yeah, I am privileged as a white human being?
Such a great question. And I think I want to just quickly address the meditation part, because
okay,
I think once I learned to meditate, I was practicing medicine quite happily. And I think for the lion's share of people, meditation just kind of helps you function. It helps you function when you weren't functioning, or function better if you're from whatever your baseline is, it helps you function better and feel happier. But it also gives this for me. And I realize I could practice medicine until I'm 65 and I'd be just fine. Mm-hmm. But I know there was something more. And I think meditation continues to give me this access to this like inner instinct or this inner intuition and this desire that like when something comes up that feels a little scary or outside my comfort zone, that's where I want to be rather than staying in the protective role. Cause I could have stayed in medicine, and not that it's easy and any, obviously like sure. This is pre-COVID before I left, but the meditation kind of rewiring the way our bodies habitually process stress can allow people to expand consciousness in a lot of different ways and expand their ability to be in situations that may not have felt comfortable or even possible before. So I think that intuition was what led me to the retreat. And then what was fighting back about me not going to the retreat was the little voice inside that wants me to stay safe and the status quo, which is the opposite of where you want to be. And so I think in terms of what I've learned in terms of privilege is that first off, like I am a super well-intending left-sided, progressive white woman. And I still had no idea what I didn't know. And there's a whole world out there that I have come to realize is set up to protect the access to power and the access to trust and the access to resources for people who have skin that looks like mine. And
well, I totally agree with you. And it's so interesting the way you describe that as you, my works in human development and consciousness. So I'm glad you said that, because I was just going to say meditation expands consciousness. And in my world of development, the listeners often hear me talk about the 12 stages of human development. So I would say even more than just the expansion of consciousness, what we know happens is you quite possibly lean into another stage of development. And that's where I see the connection to anti-racism, because the average American, for instance, is at stage 4 or 5 and there's 12. So oh, wow. You can imagine how limited our perspectives are in general across the board. So in my worldview, as you progress to higher states of and stages of consciousness and later stages of development, you see how things are interconnected in a way that you have never seen them before. And what you begin to learn is that there is this rippling effect that exists. And certainly I had such high hopes when COVID began, because I thought now we can no longer deny that we are in fact a collective global society, but somehow we managed to still divide in the midst of that and turn COVID into a political religious debate. I don't quite know how that's happened. You as a physician must be scratching your head as well. But well, we're all human beings and we're all in this together. And when one of us is oppressed, it affects all of us, much less when a greater, larger population has been oppressed for generations. And we know the impact and the rippling effect of generational trauma. So I think the work that you're doing is just so vitally important. And I know, and I would love your comment on this before we get into the emotional freedom technique, because even to your point of comfort, which I had not really thought about before, I have experienced this in my own neighborhood where I was struggling within myself as a progressive, questioning, have I become a racist? Because with all the apartments that are being built in my town of Orlando, we have now more traffic, more crime. We have an influx of people from larger cities who come from, you know, very diverse backgrounds who are in survival mode. And a lot of things have changed here in my little bedroom, safe, comfortable community. And frankly, I don't like it. I don't like that my supermarket is now flooded. You can't find parking and blah, 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 blah. And so I was starting to question my own integrity on this conversation that I have been very open and progressive about throughout my life. And what I came to finally realize was, no, it's not a racial issue for me so much as it is a, and maybe I'm just kidding myself, so I want your comment, so much as it is, to your point, a safety comfort issue. It brings up history for me because I come from the inner cities of Los Angeles, where I was not safe as a child. The crime was very, very intense. I was one of maybe, I don't know, three kids in school that had blonde hair. You know, I grew up in a very diverse part of East Los Angeles. So I was discriminated against. So I had to really dig deep to understand within myself, what is causing you this concern? Is it racism? Is it just, to your point, looking for comfort and safety? Is it a combination of all of it? What are your thoughts as I share my own journey with you and on this topic?
I think it's a great question. And I think it's really hard to say those things out loud and to acknowledge, like, hey, look, I have some biases. I'm having these feelings. I don't know what to do with them. And I think people get so afraid to talk about it that they're going to be like, you know, cast out of society, that people are often afraid to talk about it. And I think one thing that's been helpful for me just to start with is that there's no such thing as like not racist. We've all been racialized in this culture from the day we're born. Everybody has been, no matter what their background is, and they've been racialized in different ways. So it's reflected inwardly or it's reflected outwardly. So I don't really think of life as I'm racist or not racist, because some of the most racist people that I know, I don't know them, but that I am aware of, say that they're the least racist person in the room, when that's absolutely not true. So rather than saying racist versus not racist, it's, am I racist or anti-racist? And anti-racist it's not a label that, like, it's not dynamic. I'm sorry, it's not static, it's dynamic. Mm. So in every moment of every day, this is a concept that Ibram Kendi talks about in How to Be an Anti-Racist. It's a conscious, deliberate choice to be racist or anti-racist. Now, this doesn't mean that if you're either like telling racist jokes or you're like Mother Teresa, it's not that kind of polar thing, but even silence is complicity in a system. So I always say that I'm an aspiring anti-racist, because there's stuff that I do all the time where I benefit from privilege. I do try to speak up as much as I can, but there's always more to do. And there's always decisions to make that could be better. And so I think first off, to recognize that it's a work in progress and it's an evolution and it's a continuously conscious choice. I think also to recognize that we as white people, I'll speak for myself, but I feel like it's a society thing and that's pretty well proven. We are raised to fear Black and Brown people. It's in the media. It's everything that we have been taught in this culture is to fear people who don't look like us, to think of people who don't look like us as less than. Whether or not
it's true for them too, don't you agree? I mean, I had a guy years ago that worked for me. He was Puerto Rican, and you know, pretty much here in Orlando, just on the other side of the lake here, you go over the bridge, and that whole community is pretty much a Latin community. Mm-hmm. And he was fearful to come into my community. He was fearful to work for me. And when I remember in the early days, when we'd go somewhere like to, you know, a corporate room where I was doing a training or whatever, and he would go with me, the first time I could see he was visibly nervous being in my car. And I looked at him and said, what's going on with you? I mean, you just seem really jumpy. And he said, I'm frankly afraid I'm going to be pulled over being with a white blonde woman, you know, like they're going to think I've kidnapped you. Because he came from the inner city of, you know, New York. And they just don't come outside of their own culture. And so I got very deliberate about bringing him into other parts of town and restaurants and exposing him to Japanese food and different things so that he would be more well-rounded and feel more comfortable, so that when we did go into corporate environments together, he didn't feel that he was less than. Mm-hmm. And I remember taking him to a national speakers convention one time. He was the only Latin guy there. And he like freaked out that he was the only Latin guy there. And I said, well, this is what tells you it's an opportunity. You could be the first Latin speaker in the National Speakers Association. You know, we joked about it, but it was very, very difficult for him to come into my white world, let's say.
Yeah, exactly. So I think knowing that our culture has trained us to think of non-white as not trustworthy, not smart enough, all these things. Mm-hmm. And that often gets internalized by those people. So I can't speak for Black and Brown people, but many of them have shared with me and I've read like, yes, mm-hmm. we almost get taught to be afraid of our own communities. And then, mm-hmm. so there's that. So we're taught to be afraid of what's out there, but what's actually happening is that whiteness is what's causing the damage and the harm. That's what's causing harm to Black and Brown communities. It's not
because we have the power.
Because we have the power and there's mass yeah. incarceration and policing and all sorts of things. So I had a conversation with a Black friend of mine and she was talking about moving into a neighborhood where I grew up. And she lives right now, like more where I was living as an adult in Atlanta. And she was talking about, you know, safety. And I was like, oh my God, it's the safest neighborhood ever. It's ridiculously safe. And then I realized that she wasn't talking about crime, which my implicit automatic brain goes to probably Black people in crime. I don't think it's right. I don't like that about myself, but I can't pretend that my brain hasn't been programmed to think that. Well, she meant, are her little boys going to be safe walking around the neighborhood as Black boys, white people causing the harm? And so I think that recognizing that like discomfort and fear are different things. And we may, our bodies, when our bodies start to be like, oh, there's something different, our bodies sometimes have that fear, that stress response, but we're not actually in danger. We may be uncomfortable, but we're not in danger. Sometimes we are in danger, but knowing that, like, if someone's saying to a Black person, oh, you're raising your voice or making me uncomfortable, that's not fear. There's no life-threatening thing happening there. That's a discomfort response based on society conditioning of white people being better, which is wrong, but it's ingrained in us. And our response as white people doesn't have to be call the cops, violent things are going to happen. Our response can be like, ooh, I'm uncomfortable. What's that about? Rather than it blaming the other person, because we as a culture, me as an individual white person, I can cause a lot of harm. I can make people very uncomfortable because there's a historical legacy of Black and Brown people being harmed by white people. So I think that, you know, in terms of your neighborhood, it's a hard question. Change is always difficult. I think I don't have a perfect answer to it, except that it's in the immediate picture, it feels like it's right there with you. It is right there with you. In the bigger picture, it's like, what has led to this? What has led to, what are the systemic problems that have led to lack of access to healthcare and education and all sorts of other things to communities who aren't white, to housing restrictions?
Yeah. I mean, that to me, it's not even, you know, if I move outside my own comfort zone for a moment, because I look at it as we're in I'm often heard to say one of the most important evolutionary periods in human history. And with that comes a lot of migration. You know, where everyone is migrating to somewhere different now because where they are no longer feels safe or comfortable, or they can't make a living or whatever the story is. We would probably have a lot more influx from Europe right now if they were allowed to, you know, migrate more so than they are. So the apartments to me are just a response to our housing situation and how out of balance our economic situation is and what's accessible. So it's just a wake-up call to a systemic issue, as you pointed out. But it's happened so quickly,
yeah,
is what I think has surprised all of us who are in little kind of suburban bedroom communities that had no crime. And I'm not saying that anyone who lives in an apartment is necessarily a criminal, but what I am saying is that it allows for more of transition, you know, people coming and going. And so you don't necessarily, and they're not necessarily people of color. I mean, I was right here in my two blocks away in a Marriott because I had some water damage in my home, and 5 o'clock in the morning had a guy coming up, a really scary looking guy who was white, and there was a big party in the hotel. And I, you know, he looked like he was delivering something. That was my assumption. There's like drugs being delivered, because there was like five guys scared the heck out of me in the elevator, you know, at 5 o'clock in the morning. And it was a wake up call for me, because I thought, wow, I don't realize what goes on in a community at 4 or 5 in the morning, because I'm usually either getting ready to leave for a flight or something else. And so it's not to me a color so much of our conversation of black or brown as it is we're in a transition where, on the higher side, if I put on my progressive hat, is a good thing that people are being given opportunities to move into suburban communities that are safer, that perhaps maybe have better school systems or whatever. But the influx is a lot. So I'm curious how you are working with individuals and or businesses to help shift these perspectives, to help people like myself make sense of the really fast, immediate, ever-changing way that we think about anti-racism.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you think about diversity, equity, and inclusion work, also called DEI work, which I know you spoke about in a previous episode, mm-hmm. that's like applying systems. It's like the how. Applying mm-hmm. systems and making an organization or a neighborhood or something, you know, any organization, putting structures in place to prevent discrimination in a systematic way and to help people feel more inclusive. But what happens sometimes is if we put these systems in place, but the people who are living in the systems don't understand why we're doing it or the importance of doing it or how we're all kind of interconnected and other ways that racism, as I mentioned, can show up. That's not just, I don't tell racist jokes, therefore I'm not part of the problem, like that. Mm-hmm. Then the changes that we're trying to make don't always stick. And so what we really do is the who and the why. Like who are these people that we may be thinking of as different from us? Why has society taught us to think certain ways about certain people, whether it's by race or by ability or by class or by religion or gender? Like, why have we been conditioned this way? How can we like rehumanize the way we see other people and understand why we're doing the work that we do and how it impacts all of us? Because it's not a zero-sum game. There's a great book by Heather McGee called The Sum of Us, which is really powerful. And it talks about all the different ways that racism harms white people, like financially, quality of life, student debt, all of that is all a result of racism. And so I think teaching people why we're doing this work, rather than it just being some sort of restrictive, prescriptive thing that we're supposed to be doing, checking the box, but not understanding the why or the how, I'm sorry, the why or the who, I think it gives us a better sense of what we're working towards.
I love that whole conversation around how it impacts white people, because that's kind of where I often go with people who are, you know, very, very racist that I run into is, and I think we see more of that, people being more outward with it since the 2016 election, at least I certainly have. And I feel like, you know, one way to appeal to them is to help them understand that as a society, you know, it's the old adage, we're only as strong as our weakest link. And if we're not helping people who are oppressed and marginalized in some way, whatever, you know, there needs to be a lot of systems and a lot of things in place in order to give them the opportunities to advance their way of life, then they become a burden on society, because we're, you know, it's the prisons, you know, it's the lack of education, it's the lack of housing, it's the lack of you know, food and sustenance and the ability to care for their children. And then who picks that up is, you know, the rest of society. And I think I read somewhere, I'd love your comment on this, that I think it's by 2030, the global society will outweigh, and I mean, will be primarily made up of Asians, indigenous people, Blacks and Latins. So the Caucasian race will be the minority. And to me, it just makes sense that we have to find a way for everyone to live their highest, best life. And we can't do that if we're continuing to divide. What are your thoughts around where the global society is going and what I just said in terms of the weakest link and our responsibility to do what we can to give them more opportunity?
Sure. You know, I don't know about like statistics and stuff like that. I would maybe reframe the concept of weakest link, because I'm not sure exactly who that would entail, mm-hmm. but I would suggest that because I think one of the things that happened is in, like, I don't know, 1619, there was this big rebellion called Bacon's Rebellion, and poor Black people and poor white people teamed up to rebel against the landed aristocracy and the wealthy landowners. And what the landowners did in response to that was separate Black people from white people and give white people more privileges and make Black people like slaves forever. So what they've done is sort of like pit people who would be natural allies, pit them against each other. So the white people say, well, at least I'm not whatever group is society is saying is below me, which in that case would be people who are enslaved Black people. So as long as the culture of whiteness continues to separate people who could potentially band together to lift each other up, we're going to continue to have people who are refusing vaccines, refusing to wear masks, dying themselves because they don't want to allow, refusing healthcare because they don't want those same privileges to be given to Black people. Refusing, I mean, and there's a great book called Dying of Whiteness that is also incredible that talks about this. So I feel like the culture of whiteness, not white people specifically, but the culture of whiteness, I feel like that's the weak link. And I feel like that is what needs to be addressed so that we can all realize it's not either us or them or us. It's we can all work to lift each other up. And that doesn't take anything away from me as a person or me as a person, as a part of a identity. So I think that the problems that we have in our country right now that are draining resources are a result of racism. They are not a result of the people who are impacted by racism.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think I like how you've reframed it. In my mind, I'm basically thinking that until the white culture recognizes that we can never be a sustainable, healthy, profitable nation until all of us have opportunity, that to me is the weakest link. But you've reframed it. I was making it more of an us and them conversation, and see how easy it is to do that, right?
Right.
When you live in white privilege, where what you stated is more what I'm meaning, is that it is really about us unifying to solve all of our problems, and they are not the problem. It is a systemic issue that must be addressed by all of us. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, exactly.
Where I think that some of the people that I encounter who are very, very far right, you know, the ones that want to, quote, make America great again, think that it will be better if they're no longer in the picture, whoever they are, and we are continuing to be the ones increasing in power. And that to me is the biggest issue of all, that we can't recognize that we're all Americans or we're all humans and that we need to solve these issues together. Now, tell me then, we have a few minutes left. Let's talk about how the technique of emotional freedom tapping is helping people change perspectives along the lines that we're talking.
Sure. So the emotional freedom technique is also called EFT or tapping, and it's a really great stress reduction modality, wellness tool that not only helps reduce stress, but it also helps manage intense emotions that may be perceived potentially as negative. And if I am going into this work and I am wanting to be, like, for me as a white woman, ways I could use it, if I am wanting to speak up, I see something happening, I see a man talking to a woman in a bad way, or I see someone mistreating a person who's gay, or I see a Black person, like a microaggression, and I want to speak up, but I'm scared of what I might lose or how it might affect me, and then I don't speak up, then that is silence and that's complicity. So instead, what I could do is potentially use tapping, which is, you know, 5 or 10 minutes. It's different places on the head and chest, face and chest, saying out loud whatever it is that's bothering us that has really great scientific evidence and reframed the way our brain is perceiving stress. So it's actually turning a distressing situation into something that is no longer causing a fight or flight reaction. Then I can tap on that fear and then I can be like, oh, okay, I'm just going to go and I'm no longer afraid. I'm going to speak up. Or if I am doing, you know, if I said something bad as a white person, I said something harmful or not as a white person, perhaps, you know, in any other context where I'm saying something that is harmful to someone who has a disability, that can provide a lot of shame and a lot of guilt. Mm-hmm. And if I don't process that in a healthy way, in a productive way, I might go into a space and just like make it all about me and be like, I feel so bad. Oh my God. And there's this concept called white tears, which is like a white woman comes into a space and like gets upset or gets called out for something and then starts to cry. And then all of a sudden everyone is tending to the emotional well-being of the white woman. And it's just something that sort of culturally happens. And it causes a lot of harm because it takes the attention off of the people who are actually on the receiving end of the harm. And so if I'm feeling guilt and shame, I can process that with tapping and then realize I'm human, I'm making mistakes, I'm learning. And then I can go into a space and contribute to work that is already being done by incredible people in a way that's productive and not sort of pulling attention towards me unnecessarily. If I'm had a difficult interaction on Facebook or something is really making me mad on Facebook, I can tap and calm that down so that I don't go into this whole like back and forth with someone on Facebook and say something that I might regret or that isn't really helping, or with a family member who might be have want to do better or might not want to do better and has, you know, thoughts that are beliefs that are different from mine. I can tap to help me process either a difficult interaction or to prevent a difficult interaction. So it's used in that way. And then for people who are on the receiving end of systemic racism and oppression, how does it feel to have an aggression or microaggression committed towards you? So if there's a fear or a sadness, tapping on that, there's actually a, what's it called? I think it's, for some reason, forgetting, maybe healing justice, which is basically self-care and self-wellness as a tool of resistance in communities who are marginalized. So it's like the act of resistance is taking care of oneself. So that can be a bigger thing or just a smaller thing. Someone said this to me and it was really traumatizing or triggering and I'm going to tap so I don't carry this around with me. Or I want to speak up to my boss. I am afraid that I might get punished for it or blamed for it. I want to speak up for someone else. Tapping through that fear.
Now, is the tapping literally a physical tapping on a specific part of the body? Yeah. And if so, how do you know which part of the body to do that?
There are set tapping points on the face chest. There's, let's see, side of the hand, top of the head, inner corner of the eyebrow, side of the eye, under the nose, chin, one on the chest and one under the arm. So the, what I don't know, like 9 or 10, and you go through them in a sequence. Like the same thing every time, and you tap on them just kind of lightly. And I've got lots of, you know, instructional videos about this and stuff on my website, or anybody can go to YouTube and just type in what is tapping or Google. And by tapping on these parts of the, on these different energy centers or meridians and saying out loud what's bothering me. So I'm scared. I'm scared. I'm scared that if I speak up, I'm going to get in trouble. I'm scared, whatever it is, that kind of calms the nervous system down and rewires how we process stress. So it's a very kind of formulaic way to process any difficult emotion that may come up. And it's not designed to make the bad feelings go away. It's designed to allow us to like process.
Like when you acknowledge them, with my work, we would say you acknowledge them in the system. It makes space for that, them to whatever, if it's whatever is going on in the system to settle down or relax so that something new can emerge. Rather than repressing it, it just gets louder. That's how we talk about it in my field. So it makes total sense to me. I want to give us your website before I forget so that people can visit and learn more about your work and the emotional freedom technique should they desire. We'll make sure that's in the show links or in the show notes.
Sure. It's jillwener.com, JILLWENER.com. And that has links to all my meditation programs, my tapping programs, and my anti-racism work. Okay. The anti-racism website is consciousantiracism.com. And you can link to that through my personal website or my, you know, my the website with my name.
Now, if somebody wanted you to come in and speak to their company or one of their events or whatever, I know you're doing a lot of that. Yes. Is there an opportunity on the website to contact you for that?
Yes. Yes. There's a page about public speaking and they can just put in a contact form or they can email me as info@jillwener.com.
Okay. And then the book is, tell me the name of that again, your podcast. We'll have the link for that. And then you have the Conscious Anti-Racism. That's the book. That's the title.
Yeah. It's Conscious Anti-Racism, Tools for Self-Discovery, Accountability, and Meaningful Change.
So in the few minutes that we have, Jill, maybe give an example, if you will, of something that someone could do. And I've been very transparent in sharing some of my own fears that have come up and realizing that they come from my background, my child, and I think a lot of our biases do based on my experience in the field, but to recognize my own coming from, you know, an indigent, very unsafe environment as a child, you know, surfacing here where I live now, it was kind of interesting to me. Give me an example then of a tool that someone might access to help them maybe have a shift in consciousness around racism so that they could step into being more of an anti-racist activist, whatever that means.
Exactly. It means different things for different people. I mean, I would say start with my book.
Okay.
We think it's great. We're really proud of it. And it's got a lot of the background stuff and more of my story and different ways that we can recognize racism, the way it shows up in our lives, and then goes through a lot of the tools. We have an online course as well that's on the website. And we have one for healthcare professionals and one for non-healthcare people. So those are good ways to start. I think there's a book called Me and White Supremacy by Layla Saad, which is fabulous. It's a sort of workbook kind of thing where you're having to you learn about a topic and then having to do a lot of self-reflection. And it's not easy to do, but it's really powerful. And I think if you've read our book or taken our course, you have the tools to then process that discomfort that comes up, because going into this work without having a way to do it, without having a bit of a roadmap can be can feel overwhelming. It shouldn't, but it does. You know what I mean? I wish it didn't, but it often does. So I think that's a great way to start. And then also one thing that I really love is like, look around your life, look around your social media feeds. And if everybody looks like you, mm-hmm. not you specifically as Sharon,
I know what you mean.
Then do something about that. And not tokenizing, but start following people on social media who are, you know, I'm a white woman talking about anti-racism. I'm happy for you to follow me, but I would much prefer you follow Black folks who are talking mm-hmm. about anti-racism, Indigenous people, Latinx people, Asian people, people with disabilities, people who have fat bodies. You know, follow mm-hmm. people who are going to teach you about a different type of world, the perspectives and the real life, like humanness of people who aren't just like me. Because I think that's a really great way to start, is to make sure that it's less other and that we're realizing that we're all human beings. And I think that really goes a long way. Buying books written by Black people, even if it's fiction, who's in your Netflix queue, you know, that is a good way to start.
Well, I think based on what you've said too, I think just noticing where white privilege shows up in your life, mm-hmm. you know, like going back to the example of the changes in my own neighborhood. I mean, white privilege here, you know, again, we're just this little bedroom community. And I never thought of us as all white before, because we have diversity in the neighborhood. You know, we have a lot of diversity in the neighborhood. You know, there wasn't a lot, the traffic, there wasn't the inconvenience or the lack of comfort, to use your language, around traffic and some of that, because we were in an overpopulated community mm-hmm. and we were kind of unknown. So to me, you know, that's part of what I'm looking at, is like that has been a white privilege experience for me, to have mm-hmm. the ability to live in this little quiet town, you know, that no one, it's not like being in inner city where I grew up in LA, where, you know, we were all kind of meshed together and you survived or you didn't. It was, right. It was an interesting place to grow up, you know? Anyway, well, I'm grappling with all of these issues, as I think most of us are. And I thank you for the work that you're doing out there, Dr. Wiener, because it's very, very important, no matter what color your skin or no matter what your background, we're at a point in history where things need to change. So I'm glad you're one of those change agents out there. We'll be sure to put all those the links to your work and to the books that you've mentioned, because those are certainly good pieces of advice for us. Any last bit of wisdom you would offer anyone out there who's grappling with some of the issues that we've talked about?
Yes. I would say, first off, don't ask Black people to teach you unless you're paying them. So learn, mm-hmm. buy books, take courses where they have put there's a ton of amazing knowledge out there. Treat it like you're researching a new car and do the work to find the sources. And also find other white people, if you're a white person listening to this, or people in your own identity that you can talk through some of this stuff with. And I do allyship coaching. So I do this work one-on-one with white people who like need a place to have these conversations and grapple with things, because it's hard. We don't want to put our grappling onto people who are harmed by our mm-hmm. systems in our culture. And so we want to make sure we're doing that in a space that is not causing harm.
Or to ourselves, because there's a lot of guilt and shame in even having these thoughts.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
That, at the that same too. Time. Sure. Sure.
Yeah.
So, well, I thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. And I hope we can revisit some of these conversations as you move along. And we look forward to staying on top of, in touch with your work.
Absolutely. I'm happy to talk about it and happy to come back.
Well, listeners, I know that this is a provocative conversation. I hope you've leaned into it with an open heart and that you'll consider some of the readings that she shared with us. Certainly visit Dr. Jill Wiener's website, as we stated earlier, and to always remember that every challenge, no matter how big, how small, each is intended to bring you to your highest potential. And I thank you so much for listening. If you found this content valuable, I always like to remind you of the four ways that you can work with me to perhaps strengthen relationships that might support your overall life or your business growth and sustainability. One, of course, is I'd love you to order a copy of my book, The Pursuit of Time and Money, where we look at some of these discrepancies and how people experience time and money and the havoc that it can cause until you understand some of those experiences and why they occur. You certainly can join my new Facebook group, The Alchemy of Humans, where we're taking deeper dives into what it means to be human in our ever-changing culture. Certainly, you can schedule a free discovery call at go.onesub.com/meetwithSharonSpano. And finally, I want to encourage you to leave us a review on iTunes if you feel that this was meaningful for you, because that allows us to access more listeners and guests like Dr. Jill Wiener and bring those lessons back to you here on the show. So until next time, this is Dr. Sharon Spano reminding you to live your best life. Stay well.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Other Side of Potential podcast. Please leave us a rating and review on your favorite podcast platform so we can continue helping family businesses thrive. For more information on how Dr. Spano can help you in your own family business, visit SharonSpano.com to schedule a complimentary consultation.